This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. It was a wild week in the legislature, from the arrest of a House member to a death penalty vote in the Senate to movement on Medicaid. Yesterday, a key committee in the House voted to back reauthorization of the state's Medicaid expansion program for another 2 years. Under the bill, hospitals and insurance companies would pick up what the feds will no longer be covering starting next year. House Majority Leader Dick Hinch said there was no other option.
I don't have knowledge of any other plan to take care of the 48,000 people that are currently on the program. What do we do with them January 1st, 2017?
Also yesterday, the state Senate tabled a proposal to suspend the death penalty. The bill's lead sponsor, Republican Kevin Avard, who once supported capital punishment, says there are too many examples of people improperly ending up on death row to remain confident the punishment is worth the risk.
You know, we are all capable of fallibility, and if we have 156 people that, like I said, have been exonerated, we should take a real sober look at this.
Meanwhile, earlier in the week, the legislature was rocked by felony charges against a Nottingham state representative. Kyle Tasker has been charged with 4 felonies, including using a computer to lure a minor to have sex and drug possession with intent to sell. A search of Tasker's home turned up guns and what prosecutors call an enormous amount of drugs. Here's House Speaker Sean Jasper on Tasker's arrest.
Meeting up with a 14-year-old girl for sex, that was certainly shocking. I think many of us suspected that Representative Tasker had issues with drugs, but certainly the scope of the allegations are stunning.
And on a lighter note, with baseball spring training underway, Nashua native Tim Neverett will be the new play-by-play announcer for the Red Sox. It's a dream come true for the lifelong fan and broadcaster.
I understand the meaning of Red Sox baseball to New England sports fans because I lived it. I grew up with it, grew up around it. So I think I get it more than most.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week are Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. A busy week at the State House. Gary, thank you for taking time out.
I'm glad to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Trent Spinner, executive editor for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Trent, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start, gentlemen, with that story about Representative Tasker. This was a big story at the State House this week. Trent, to you first, what's the latest that we know about this?
Well, this was a really disturbing story. Kyle Tasker is a 30-year-old state representative from Nottingham, and he had taken over. He was sending messages through Facebook to a 14-year-old girl, and the mother found these messages and found them disturbing and called the police. So detectives from the Nottingham Police Department took over the account and essentially set up a sting operation. And so a detective, he didn't realize he was talking to a detective, but he tried to set up, there were some really disgusting details, lurid details that we couldn't even print, but tried to set up a meeting with this 14-year-old girl to have, allegedly, to have sex with her. And when he showed up with some drugs and a loaded handgun. What he found instead were detectives from the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force and Nottingham detectives, and they took him – they arrested him immediately. He was taken – they did a search warrant of his house, and they found tons of drugs and I would say more than $10,000 worth of firearms. And the photos – they released some photos of the evidence, and there was a lot of drug – just you could see in the photos, scales and marijuana, all kinds of stuff. And so police said that this was an enormous haul. He was immediately removed. He was on the Child and Family Services committee at the House, and he was immediately removed by Speaker Sean Jasper. And there's been a lot of political fallout since that.
Wow. So in addition to luring the 14-year-old girl to have sex, looked like he was planning to meet her with drugs and maybe threaten her with a firearm. So this is just, you know, incredibly serious on a number of levels.
Very serious charges.
Wow. Gary Reyna, what was the reaction at the State House? You were there.
Well, I think it's Sean Jasper, the Speaker of the House, said, you know, I don't think too many people were too surprised at the fact that he was involved in drugs and so on. But I think they were very shocked at the extent to which he was involved and the amount of drugs that they found, the kind of drugs that they found. And the involvement with the 14-year-old really shocked everybody. To the point where, I mean, there was talk around the State House yesterday that, that when the House comes in next Wednesday, there may be a motion to go to remove him as a member. I don't think probably leadership wants that because they got several hundred bills to deal with in 2 days, and they probably don't want that distraction. But anybody can make the motion, and it's up to the House who sits, and he may not be there.
You know, picking up on something you said, Gary, that people at the State House weren't too surprised about the drugs. Why didn't folks at the State House, you know, make moves on this earlier? If you have a state rep who sits on an important committee, you suspect he's got not only doing drugs himself, but intent to sell is one of the charges. You just kind of wonder, why did they let this sit?
Well, I don't think anybody thought that he was selling drugs, you know. But there are a number of representatives who are kind of play it loose a little bit with the contraband, so to speak. So, I mean, he's not alone in that.
And we had a story today where we talk about how, police suspected him in other crimes.
Yeah, I had read that, yeah.
But they weren't able to prove anything. And so, at a certain point, you need some threshold of evidence, right, to prove that somebody's breaking the law for either police to charge them or for an indictment or for the House to remove a member, which would be a very serious thing to do.
Dean, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, whenever something like this happens and Representative Tasker is, I think, a third term representative, the most frequent question I get is how did somebody like this get elected to the State House? And, you know, the issue is we have a large House of Representatives, 400 people. When most people go in to vote on Election Day, you look at that list of names for state representative, and you may not really know who these people are. They're not – some are, but some are not heavily vetted. And so you just don't really know that much about them. And, you know, maybe you know their party identification, and that may move you one way or the other. But they're just sort of not the ability to kind of heavily vet these hundreds and hundreds of candidates. And so we get these surprises. You know, I'm sure Gary could tell you lots of stories. We get these surprises periodically of representatives who are just sort of other than what you thought they were. And people always ask me, well, how did that person get in? And that's how it happens.
I mean, Tasker is in what's called a flotario, which is basically a multi-town district, which is fairly large. And I mean, there's four or five seats in it. And the last two elections, he's been the top vote getter in that district. I mean, and the only reason you can really say that probably is because the name is well known in that area. The family has a business here and has been there forever and ever. But so, I mean, it's not like people don't know who he is, but they don't really know who he is.
Well, and this gets to something that also has been discussed, Gary, when cases like this come up. Dean's right. This is not the first time. People say, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, there was a lot of little newspapers that would cover people more closely and kind of investigate these races. Now, you know, nobody has time or staff or whatever.
Well, Trent can answer that.
I don't think that there's been a huge decline. I think that as much as, you know, those smaller papers have decreased, it's become so much easier for us to find information about people. And so we can pull up records online. We can look at your Facebook page. And we do that. And so the question is, though, like, do we get that initial tip? You know, it doesn't help us. And this has happened recently. Like, somebody told us, hey, how did this convicted sex offender get elected to the town council in a small town somewhere? They told us a year after the person was elected. I mean, that doesn't really help us. So we've always relied on people in these towns to tip off journalists. And so that's really what's not happening quite as much, I think.
Well, and another person prominent in Granite State politics was arrested this week. Jerry DeLamis, a Tea Party activist, co-chair of Veterans for Trump, was arrested Thursday during an FBI raid. Trent, what's this all about?
This was another incredible story. I mean, this was a crazy week in New Hampshire news. Jerry DeLamis was arrested in an FBI raid. I mean, FBI fully, you know, like almost a SWAT team went into his house, pulled him out of there. And this was all – the crazy part about this is we usually find out about arrests and stuff. We get a press release or someone tips us off. This was breaking live on social media, right? The former party of the Republican Party was posting breaking news. This just happened. Jerry DeLamis was just pulled out of his house by fully armed FBI agents. And no one knew what was happening, what the charges were. And so we were able to confirm the arrest. Actually, Dan Tuer, our political reporter, called Susan DeLamis, State Rep Susan DeLamis, and she was in tears, saying, "My husband was just arrested. They just pulled him out of the house. I don't know what's going on." And as Dan was on the phone with her, I said, "You know, we should find out what is happening." So I called the court, the federal district court, and I said, "Can you just tell me what kinds of charges?" And when they started reading the list of charges, was incredible. You know, conspiracy to commit an offense against the United States, threatening a federal officer, going across state lines to commit offense. I mean, like very serious charges that were shocking. And so here's what happened. He went out to the Bundy Ranch in 2014 in Nevada. There were a bunch of ranchers out there, and they were allegedly letting their cattle graze on federal land, even though they weren't supposed to. Federal agents went in to seize the cattle and say, "You're not allowed to be on this land anymore."
And this is a 20-year standoff, by the way.
This is a 20-year.
So
yeah, exactly.
He had been avoiding following the rules and paying those federal fines for 20 years.
For 20 years. And in 2014, federal agents finally went in and said, "All right, enough." But the Bundy family essentially said, "This is our land. We have rights," and called all these people. I think 200 people ended up coming to defend these cattle, and they were fully armed. Basically, the FBI is accusing Jerry DeLamis of being a mid-level organizer of this effort to, make sure that federal agents couldn't get on the property, make sure that federal agents couldn't seize the cattle. And there's some pretty – I mean, it's a 64-page indictment, and he's in there, and he's facing very serious charges.
Well, I happened to drive by the courthouse yesterday and saw all the news trucks out there, so that was the first tip I had. Gary, go ahead.
I think what's, interesting about it is that he's the Veterans for Trump chairman, which is going to probably put New Hampshire back on the Huntington Post and a few other national news media for that as well. But, I mean, his wife has been in the legislature for a while. And he's run for office, too. He's run for the sheriff of Stratford County and a few things like that. Fairly well known in the Tea Party movement in New Hampshire.
All right. Well, the number for you to join us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Dean, let's turn to another story that caught our attention this week. Talking about presidential politics, while the candidates have long moved on from New Hampshire, there's still some reverberations. Mm-hmm. I'm throwing this to you because our other two guests are from the union leader. And this concerns a story concerning the union leader. You know what I'm going to ask, Dean?
Absolutely.
This week, the union leader retracted its endorsement of Chris Christie. What did the paper say?
It said they got it wrong. If you recall back to the primary, the union leader endorsed Chris Christie, was very aggressive in attacking the campaign of Donald Trump. Certainly not big Donald Trump fans. As we know, subsequently, Chris Christie endorsed Donald Trump, and we saw that press conference the other night after Super Tuesday in which Chris Christie was standing right over Donald Trump's right shoulder there on the stage. It's not just the union leader. He's undergoing withering criticism. I think 6 or 7 papers in New Jersey called for his resignation as governor. He's taken a bit of a beating over this, but he believes that this is sort of the best move for him going forward. He's term limited in New Jersey. He can't run again anyway. So the union leader wrote a fairly short item the other day, editorial, basically saying, we got it wrong. It was a mistake. you know, we should not have endorsed Chris Christie, and just basically expressing unhappiness with this move of endorsing Donald Trump.
And you know what I think is it was so shocking to so many people who supported Chris Christie. Yeah. You know, this was a front page signed editorial from our publisher, Joe McQuaid, yeah. who said, boy, were we wrong.
Yeah.
But Joe wasn't the only person. Meg Whitman, who was the finance
That's chairman,
right. the national finance chairman for Chris Christie, yeah. said she was shocked. Tons of local people. The House Speaker, Sean Jasper, was one of his biggest supporters, said he was shocked. Bill Grenier, who's a business from Bedford and a very well-known businessman. I think no one was ready for this. And I'll say this as an aside, that Joe had a conversation with Christie after he dropped out of the race.
That's right. He did say he wouldn't endorse him.
Exactly.
Right.
Chris Christie said, I would never do that.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yes, and I forgot about that. That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Told Joe that this is like a week or two between when he dropped out of the race and when he endorsed Trump. He said, I would never endorse Trump. And then a spokesman later clarified to say, I would never do that at that moment. So it was just really shocking to a lot of people, both yeah. locally and nationally, who supported Christie.
And you know, it is the issue that any time a candidate gets out of the race and they then endorse somebody, there's always some awkwardness because you can basically replay all the things they said negatively about the candidate. But this was particularly stark if you look at what he said about Trump before.
Right.
And also a feeling that this is maybe a little bit instrumental, that he's kind of focused on his political future, maybe probably not a VP, but maybe like attorney general in a Trump administration, something like that. He felt like this is what he needed to do.
He's going to need to get that attorney general's position because I saw a poll that had his approval ratings in New Jersey just dropped to 25%, so he's going to need something.
Well, we've got a lot of Facebook comments on this. I'll share just a few with you. Kevin says, regarding the union leader, brave move to admit when you were wrong. Andy says, I was a big Christie fan. Now he's just another say-and-do-anything politician sucking up to get the attorney general spot in the Trump administration. And Gary says it was the right decision for the UL at the time. He says, I've been involved in presidential interviews with Joe and his staff a couple of times. Timing is everything. I completely understand their position at the time and now. So that's just an example of the Facebook comments. Again, the number for you to join us as we talk about some of the week's top news stories here in the Granite State, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Well, gentlemen, hard to believe we're all still recovering from the primary, but Gary Reno, there's going to be state races this fall, and there's a very busy race for the governor here in New Hampshire, with Governor Hassan stepping out to run for U.S. Senate. What does the field look like, Gary, at this point?
Well, we have a wide open field in both cases. The Republican Party, we have two people who have announced. One is Executive Counselor Chris Sununu from the Sununu hierarchy in the Republican Party. And then first-term Rep. Frank Edelblut. And we're probably going to see a few more in that one. I think the field is quite set because Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis is talking about taking a consideration. He's played with the idea before. This isn't the first time he's talked about it. But, I mean, he just got elected mayor, so you're going to kind of wonder whether the city's going to like that if he does that. There's probably a state senator that might be getting in soon. Jeannie Forrester, she's still making noises about it. On the Democratic side, we have Executive Counselor Colin Van Osten, and we have Mark Connolly, who was the head of the Bureau of Securities at the state. And there's been talk about Stephanie Shaheen, but it kind of looks like the train's leaving the station on that one.
Wow, so lots of people, Dean.
Yeah, it really is wide open, and it's you know, it's the first time in a while there's been sort of no kind of obvious next person in either party. And so I think we're going to have a very healthy competition. I've seen a lot of these candidates, particularly on the Democratic side, but also to some extent on the Republican side, who've been out there, who have been active already organizing and fundraising. You know, it is a presidential election year, which in recent cycles has been good for Democrats in terms of their margins. So maybe that gives them a little added advantage at this point, but it's by no means certain.
Well, coming up, lots of legislative activity this week. We'll talk about that, including a vote on Medicaid expansion and on suspending the death penalty. We'll find out more in just a minute, so stay with us for more of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn our attention now to the state legislature and what happened there this week. There was a lot going on. As always, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Trent Spinner, executive editor for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News, Gary Reno, he's State House reporter at the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis is here, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And Gary Reno, I'll start with you. The big news out of the State House this week was another step along the way for Medicaid expansion. What happened?
Well, the House Finance Committee, which had the task of looking over the financial aspects of the bill, voted 18-8, which was a very good vote, bipartisan vote, strong vote for recommending that the bill go to the back to the House for the final vote to approve it. They made a few changes in it. One of them was to throw about $1.5 million a year more to the hospitals and insurance companies who are going to be paying most of the bill for the state, and to basically say if these people don't come through, then we're going to end the program in 180 days.
These people meaning the hospitals and insurers who have agreed to pick up the piece that the feds will no longer be covering.
About 65, 70% of it. I mean, they'll pick up about $35, $36 million of the $45 million that the state has to pay once the feds stop paying 100%.
Now, this gets into the intricacies of the legislature a little bit, Gary, but so House Finance says, okay, here's the financing. Here's how we think it should happen. Then they send it back to the full House for a full House vote.
For a vote, yep, before the end of the month.
And what are the expectations there?
I think it's going to – I mean, everybody expects it to pass, basically.
I mean, that's really the final test for this bill. I mean,
right. Once it gets to the Senate, it's greased.
Right.
I mean, it's gone. But I think the Senate doesn't – there's a few things in here that the Senate doesn't like, and they're going to have to come out because I think a lot of what the House put in here is stuff that the federal government's going to say, no, you can't do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, there's a this whole thing with the work requirement. Mm-hmm. There's a thing called a severability clause, which basically says if part of this is found not to be legal or constitutional or whatever, the whole law doesn't go down. Well, in what the House was doing with all their amendments when they dealt with this the first time was they took out the severability clause. So if, in fact, the work environment requirement is found not to be acceptable to the feds, then the whole thing would go down. So they want to get that back in there, yeah. And that's what's going to happen.
The issue is that you can ask for waivers for some of this stuff like the work requirement and I think the copay changes, but the federal government have not yet granted these kinds of waivers in the past.
And they never have for that.
Trent, what's your take on the politics of this at the State House?
I think it's going to be – I think what happens on the floor of the House is going to be the biggest test for this. I think that the Republican Senate leadership and the governor's office really quietly work behind the scenes to pull together the insurance – folks in the hospitals to come up with a plan that they thought would work for everyone, right? What you heard Republicans talking about throughout this process was that we don't want taxpayers to have to foot the bill. So they came up with this idea that they were going to use some of the money that the hospitals and the insurance companies weren't spending in uncompensated care. They were going to ask for some of that money back, essentially, to pay for the drop from the 100% federal funding down to what was it,
95.
So they brought everyone to the table and they came up with a plan that they thought would work. This went to the House, this went to a House subcommittee. They voted on it, bipartisan. But the question is, what Republicans in the House do? You've heard a lot of people who say, we don't want this at all. We don't care what it looks like. And so the question will be, will they have enough votes to kill this?
And do you think they will?
No.
Dean?
No, it's just – I was listening to Trent and Gary, just sitting here thinking back a couple years ago and just remembering when this whole process first started coming out of Obamacare, how incredibly polarizing the whole issue of Medicaid expansion was in comparison to now where, yeah, there are some debates about cost and who's going to bear the burden once the federal dollars dial back. But there just seems to be sort of general acceptance that now that there are almost 50,000 people in the program, you can't really turn around and just not do it. So, we're going to have these debates about funding and kind of the balance of the private-public partnership. But compared to how incredibly polarizing and difficult this issue was when it was first under consideration, I think the state's come a long way on it.
Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I think, as we said before, this is a presidential election year, which has been fairly kind to Democrats in the past 6 or 7 times that we've had this. And I think it became very clear to the leadership of the House, Republican leadership of the House, that you're not, if we don't pass this, we're in deep trouble.
Well, and we played a clip at the beginning of the hour from House Majority Leader Dick Hinch saying he sees no other plan to cover these 47,000 now people who get Medicaid expansion here in New Hampshire. So here's my political question for you, Dean, since you kind of touched on this. What about in the U.S. Senate and U.S. House races that we're going to have this fall, where many Republican candidates say, I want to repeal Obamacare? How are they going to stack that up against state legislative Republicans like Dick Hinch, who says, I don't see any other plan?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And, you know, one of the criticisms of a number of these Republican candidates is that they have not really thought beyond the repeal Obamacare aspect of the campaign pledge. You know, obviously there would have to be some kind of policy suggestion or presentation of an alternative to deal with the fact that, you know, like as you said, 47,000, almost 50,000 people now. So, you know, it's just part of a campaign. It's part of an election year to have campaign promises. You know, we'll repeal Obamacare and then you know, sort of figure out how to transition the current system to a private system.
And another interesting thing that I think we're going to have to watch is that I think Democrats, both locally and nationally, have successfully added another layer to this discussion, which is that Medicaid expansion is the best way to fight the opioid epidemic that we're facing.
There's overlap.
They overlap. And so you can't really discuss just Medicaid expansion anymore because Democrats come out and hit you on the fact on what they say is the fact that this is the best way to fight the heroin epidemic here. And so now you're really – we saw a poll come out this week from UNH that showed the heroin epidemic was the number one issue.
Wow, that's amazing.
Number one issue facing people. You know, no, it used to be number two behind the economy. I mean, first of all, it used to be at like 2% or 4%. But in the last 2 years, it's now the number one issue, just surpassing the economy for Granite Staters. And so now how do you have a debate just about Medicaid expansion without talking about that? And I think that's what is – I think that's going to be a theme that we see throughout the rest of the year.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the opioid addiction crisis, Trent, because that received some attention at the federal level this week with U.S. Senator Gene Shaheen promoting an amendment for $600 million in emergency funding – this is nationally – for law enforcement and treatment providers, and New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte making it very clear she's a strong supporter of Shaheen's effort. The amendment was rejected, however, despite that bipartisan support from New Hampshire's Senate delegation. Here's Gene Shaheen on the Senate floor.
The question that I have for those people who didn't vote to support this amendment is, how many more people have to die before we're willing to provide the resources that are needed to fight this epidemic?
So, Dean Spiliotis, strong bipartisan support, as I said, here in New Hampshire, but not enough nationally.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are obviously anytime you're dealing with funding at the level of Congress or the U.S. Senate, there are always competing priorities. You know, we heard from GOP senators in Congress that there's already almost $600 million available for the crisis. So, you know, this is just kind of additional, and Democrats did agree to not hold up the bill just because of this one amendment. So, you know, it's just competing priorities at this time of year with funding. There's a sense among the GOP that there's already enough money being directed for as important of an issue it is to New Hampshire. Kind of nationally, it's one of a number of priorities.
Mm. Gary.
I mean, in New Hampshire, we're having a fight over the money here in New Hampshire, too. I mean, there's a bill that went before the Senate that we've given $6 million more to the Governor's Commission to help fight this, and it was voted down in committee. Governor Hassan yesterday, when the revenues came out, we were like $60 million up for the year, and she's saying, okay, legislature, it's time to start taking action on some of this money aspects. We've agreed on
The
opioid crisis. We agreed on these three bills that were easy, but none of them had money in them, so let's start dealing with the money.
Again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's get your voice in on some of the top Granite State stories that we're covering this hour. 1-800-892-6477. 6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. And gentlemen, I did want to ask you about a vote in the state Senate on whether to suspend the death penalty. The Senate split 12 to 12 on this just yesterday. Here's a couple of Facebook comments on this. Should New Hampshire's death penalty be suspended? Here's what some of our folks said. Anthony says, yes, the concept doesn't bother me. It's the incompetent government, broken legal system and cost. Anthony says nationally, 5% of death row inmates are released every year. New Hampshire's legal system is just as bad as the rest of the country. Richard, on the other hand, says, no, the death penalty should not be suspended. It's a deterrent. Thank you both for those Facebook comments. Trent, why suspend instead of repeal? Usually these bills are about repealing the death penalty.
Yeah, and maybe Gary can weigh in on this because I wasn't completely sure what exactly this bill would accomplish. My understanding is that that they wanted the death penalty to be suspended until the technology existed that someone who was found who was not really guilty of the crime wouldn't be put to death. But
so that terrible mistake would not be made.
Yeah, but what is that technology? How does that work? So
yeah, Gary, go ahead.
That's the question. How does the technology work, and what exactly is it going to mean? But I mean, I think they're trying to say we need to do a little bit more on the DNA and all this and that. But I mean, there never was a vote on that bill. What we had was a vote on an amendment that would have just directly repealed the death penalty.
That's why this was interesting.
And that was 12-12, which is exactly what it was 2 years ago when it came before the Senate.
Wow.
It's been interesting to watch attitudes both locally and nationally change on the death penalty over a number of decades. And I think it's a function of, you know, more accurate the DNA testing technology, which is exonerated a number of people on death row, some very high-profile botched executions with lethal injection. So there's just a sense that the process is not working the way it was intended to work, and that it's really problematic. And you've seen a number of governors around the country suspend the death penalty for precisely this reason. And the other issue, which is always sort of a uncomfortable thing to talk about, is cost. It's a lot more expensive, some argue, to, you know, here for New Hampshire with Michael Addison, who's on the death row here. I mean, there is really no death row. The facility would have to be built, cost millions and millions of dollars. So some people make a cost effectiveness argument as well.
And while the Senate was arguing about repealing the death penalty, we had the bill in the House, which would have expanded it greatly. Would have included terrorists, or if somebody murdered someone performing their civic duty, i.e. voting, free speech, something like that, which actually would have been the most expansive death penalty of any state in the country if it would go through. But the House Criminal Justice Committee voted that it should, this week, that it should not pass. It should be killed.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Gary, because we've seen over the years in New Hampshire this push-pull. You know, there are efforts to repeal it often, sometimes almost every year. And at the same time, there are efforts to expand the category of crimes that are quote-unquote eligible for the death penalty.
The last thing that was done to the death penalty actually was to expand it, which was after the home invasion in Mount Vernon.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, thanks for those Facebook comments, Anthony and Richard. The number 1-800-892-6477. Other bills that made headlines this week, and boy, Gary, it was a very busy week for you. The issue of commuter rail keeps coming up. The idea of some kind of train service between Boston and either Nashua, Manchester, even Concord. I want to hear from everybody on this, but again, Gary, I'll start with you since you're at the State House. Why is this back on the table? We keep going back and forth on this.
Well, we have the 10-year highway plan this year, and the governor included $4 million in the 10-year highway plan in her recommendation for the engineering work and so on that would advance the commuter rail project. The House Public Works Committee voted that bill out. A lot of people expected them to take the $4 million out because obviously Republicans aren't real favor of it and Democrats usually are the way it's been working. And it was a 10-10 vote to take it out.
Another split vote this week.
So it stayed in. It stayed in, and the committee voted fairly large margin to recommend the bill pass.
Trent, do you see a different feeling around this latest effort than past efforts that have gone down the tubes, or is this more of same?
Well, I think it's going to be a very split just like the vote, I think it's going to be a very split issue. I think Republicans say, look, we have a bus and we have, you know, people have cars and there just are not enough people. I took the bus. I had an early flight out of Boston and I took the bus from Concord. It was a 5 a.m. bus and there were people who were commuting to Boston. And it was an interesting experience. And I think anyone who wants to talk about commuter rail should take that 5 a.m. bus from Concord just to get some perspective on what people go through to get to Boston. And, you know, the bus took about an hour and a half, but it dropped everybody off. There were a couple of stops in Boston. It didn't just go to South Station because it was a commuter bus. And so there were people who were getting off, like, right outside their office. And so I guess depending on which side you're on, you could either say, well, an hour and a half is way too long, or you could say an hour and a half and being dropped off in front of your office is great. And so I think it will be very divided. I think that for the first time, we're seeing a Democrat who's running for governor who's going to make this like a cornerstone of his campaign in Colin Van Ostern. But I think you'll have a lot of opposition from Republicans who are going to say, look, this thing is going to cost you $300 million to build. That's not even fully building it out. And the only way we find that money is through an income tax.
What's the role of business people in the Southern Tier on this, Dean? From my understanding, in the Southern Tier at least, Nashua, it's more of a bipartisan issue.
Yeah, that's the sense we've been hearing in recent iterations of this with some of the discussion that there are you know, pro-business Republicans in that part of the state who would like to see this for economic development reasons. But to the broader point of Gary and Trent, it is fascinating to me to the extent to which commuter rail has become a litmus test for Republicans and Democrats, not only here but nationally. Democrats love it. Republicans hate it. As Trent said, Republicans say it's a big government program that needs heavy subsidies and also a progressive plot to get people out of their cars, to deny them the liberty to drive on good highways. So I think it's – I mean, I know that Colin Van Ostern is big on it and some others are as well, but it's going to be a tough sell, I think, for the foreseeable future.
Because of the price tag that Trent mentioned.
The price tag and the opposition, it really is almost a philosophical opposition among Republicans to the concept. I see it all over the country as other places deal with congestion and costs of maintaining roads, et cetera.
And even in Nashua, where the biggest support – you would expect the biggest support to be, you had a Republican who ran for mayor there supporting the rail. And he lost.
Right. In the recent municipal elections last fall, the off-year elections. All right. Let's go to the phones, gentlemen. Andrew's calling from Keene. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead. You're on the weekly news roundup here in the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling about the commuter rail. And I just wanted to add an extra element to this that I feel that as someone who cannot drive myself, I have a disability that prevents that. I feel like a lot of the people who do the planning for these sorts of things don't keep in mind the people who can't drive either because they don't own a vehicle, they don't have the capability to do it, they want to be able to use the public transportation, those sorts of things. I feel like they just don't take that into consideration when they make these plans.
Make these plans to not have commuter rail? Is that what you're saying, Andrew?
Exactly.
You know, exactly. Thank you, Andrew, for calling. This is an issue that's also come up in shows we've done on New Hampshire's an aging state and that even people who don't have a disability now, you know, we may all be hobbling along at some point. And Andrew's saying in his situation he'd like that access.
Yeah, Andrew's point is well taken. Unfortunately, these kinds of projects are typically numbers driven, so there needs to be a certain level of ridership in order to justify or to be able to handle the cost. And that's one of the reasons, for example, why initially, you know, I would love to have commuter rail come up to Concord, but that's usually the first thing lopped off because they say there's not ridership demand to justify the cost.
Well, Andrew, thank you for calling. And in just a moment, we'll take more of your calls, questions, comments. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More in a moment. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we catch up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, we were talking about commuter rail, and as we were, an email came in from Jordan in Auburn. He says, we've been pleading for years, including those in New Hampshire's economy. I personally work in Boston, have a great job. I don't want to quit. but really want to live in New Hampshire, but drive 2 hours into the city each day is awful. An environmentally friendly train that doesn't yield to traffic would be a dream come true. Jordan says sick and tired of this partisan divide when it's so in demand by people and the industry. Again, thank you for the email, Jordan. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Couple more bills in the legislature. Wow, guys, what a week that I did want to ask you about. Gary, this is a little uncomfortable, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Okay. So a bill to prohibit women from going topless got a hearing this week. Was this just focused on state beaches, Gary, or was this everywhere?
I mean, no, not really. It was a question of equal protection under the Constitution, which is if you're going to ban women from going topless, then you have to ban men from going topless. Otherwise, you get into huge legal issues. And there were basically a lot of people, the ACLU told the legislature, you know, if you go forward with this, it's just going to be litigation from one end to the other. And why do you want to get yourself into this mess?
So they're just letting it sit, basically?
The committee voted unanimously that the bill ought to be killed.
And we got a couple Facebook comments on this as well, a lot, and I won't share all of them with you. But Tim says, the state is nearly bankrupt. We barely have enough money to plow the roads, and this is important. I don't think so. Ruthie says, seriously? What a giant waste of taxpayer dollars. She says, does live free or die not apply to women? So thank you for those comments. Another bill I wanted to ask all of you guys about concerns Keno. We keep talking about gambling, Dean Spiliotis. Yeah. Keno versus casino. Just remind us what the difference is.
Well, Keno is basically a video lottery game that you typically associate with playing in bars and restaurants. And like casino gambling, it's popped up periodically in the state legislature. It seems to be popular in the House, but not in the Senate. The concern in the Senate among people like Lou D'Alessandro is that Keno is really a distraction, that the focus should be on getting a casino up and running in the state. And so they're not particularly supportive of Keno. This latest bill would allow the towns to decide whether or not to allow it in their jurisdictions. Bars and restaurants would get 8% of the revenue. I think the state would get something like $8 million. But again, we've had this interesting divide where the Senate wants casinos, can't get it in the House. The House favors Keno, probably not going to get it in the Senate.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And boy, we've gone around and around and around dozens of times on casinos. Why, if the Senate thinks, Gary Reno, that gambling is a good way to get more money for the state, why don't they just say, all right, we're not getting what we want here, but at least we'll, you know, the half a loaf is better than none argument.
Well, except we get the political dance to go through. And if the Senate caves on Keno, they'll never get casinos. So they're never going to cave on Keno as long as they want to have casinos, although the casino argument seems to be kind of going away these days.
Really? So yeah. Has anybody here ever played Keno?
I have.
Have
seen
you?
It.
Yep.
Give us a little taste of what that's like.
Well, you have to do it drinking like a really cheap beer because that's the most fun way to do it. I don't know. It's just a lot of fun. You put money in. It's like basically playing video games, but for money.
Okay, which has more of a reward than just sort of, you know,
yeah,
ding, 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 you win.
Yeah.
Okay, so you played it in bars in Massachusetts. And
well, I swear I played it in Manchester, but now that I think
that
about it.
That was probably in one of the back rooms.
Oh, I take that back.
Well, maybe we'll move on from that to a long-running dispute between the real estate industry and the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. This is back before the state legislature this year. This has to do with what's an acceptable level of radon. Gary, can you explain this?
Well, this battle has been going on for years and years and years. Quite a while ago, the Department of Environmental Services set the guidelines. It's not really a limit because the state doesn't really have a standard, but they said 2,000 picocuries per gallon of water. After that, it becomes an issue. And the real estate agents are saying, well, you know, this is so much more than what the federal government standard is, which is 10,000, and it's driving people away from buying homes. You know, we get to the closing and all of a sudden this comes up and all of a sudden people start walking away.
Because it's too strict and too expensive?
You know, and the problem is, you know, the Tom Burak, who is the Environmental Protection Commissioner here in New Hampshire, basically said, you know, it may be the standard we have, but, you know, the federal government tried to push this several years ago. got so much pushback. I actually, you know, when you talk about the amount of radon in the air that you get from the water when you take showers and so on, it just goes out into the air. And it gets very high risk. You get from 1 to 10,000 increased risk in the water, but you get 1 to 1,000 increased risk when it gets into the air. And therefore, I mean, we should be looking even at more strict kind of guidelines than what we have now. And, I mean, radon is everywhere in New Hampshire. It's in the granite bedrock, and it's a natural occurring, but, you know, it's inconclusive, as one person said, exactly how much you should have, if you should have any.
Wow. So it's a possible cancer agent.
Yes.
And it occurs naturally here in New Hampshire because of the granite.
Yeah.
So the debate is over water and air?
The debate is over water.
Okay.
Is over the how much you should have in water. And this has been going on for a long time. So, I mean, this is nothing new. And usually to date, I mean, the legislature has basically stood with the guidelines that we have.
And what happens now with realtors is if anyone's bought a house recently, they'll test the air in your house for radon already. So now they're talking about water.
I see. And you can get a radon mitigation system for your basement because that's where it usually shows up the most.
And it's actually fairly easy to get it out of the water. So it's not like it's that expensive. The system is not as expensive as it is to get it out of the air.
Well, we got a Facebook comment from Paul who says people say it's about realtors making more money. Paul says it's about science and supporting national standards. Paul says it's also about educating buyers as to the real risks on that science and not just picking a number out of the air and calling it dangerous. Also, it's the buyer who ends up paying for the expensive remediation or the seller who experiences lower property values. It doesn't affect the realtor's earned commission or the state's transfer tax. At all. Paul, thank you for that. And that's an interesting story and one that we'll have to keep an eye on. I did want to ask you, Trent, a very sad story. A young, newly minted police officer graduated from Merrimack High School, got her first job in Virginia. And this breaks my heart. You know, she was killed on her first day.
Right. It's a terrible story. And she graduated from 2000 from Merrimack. Ashley Gwinden, I should say, is her name. She graduated from 2005, from Merrimack High School in 2005. Her father was in the armed services and took his own life after a very difficult tour in, I believe it was Iraq. But she was just committed to serving the country. And on her first day, or within the first 24 hours of being sworn in as a police officer in Virginia, she was killed in the line of duty. She went to a domestic. And when you talk to police officers, they always say you never – domestics are some of the scariest calls that they go to because you never really know what's going on inside this house. And she was killed. She was shot and two other officers were injured.
Wow.
What I've seen, I have a lot of Facebook friends who are police officers, and there's been this incredible movement all across the country where they're changing their Facebook profiles to their rookie photo, you know, their very first photo of them being sworn in or their first day, working. And I've seen dozens of people do that, and I think that there's been a big effort across the country. And Merrimack Police sent a contingent down there to go to her funeral.
Well, it's absolutely heartbreaking, and thank you for that update. And our hearts go out to her family. It's a terrible story. I did want to talk about a little bit, two more lighter stories that caught our attention this week. And one, I love this, following in the footsteps of Boston, Littleton, Salt Lake City, the Gate City, Nashua, is going to start its own street piano project. This is in Littleton. Has anyone seen it? I've seen this. Mm-hmm. You want to tell us about this, Trent?
It's awesome. You walk downtown Littleton and you can go to Cheddar's, the longest candy counter in the world, and you can walk outside and play the piano.
These are pianos. They're on the street. I think there must be at least five of them, maybe eight. They're heavily covered in the bad weather by waterproof and weatherproof covers. But yes, just as Trent said, you can yank the cover off if it is covered and you can sit down and play the piano. And I've seen people do this. I don't play the piano myself, but I've been with people who do it. This is, Dean Spiegel, it's just part of a whole idea of, you know, let's make downtown fun. Let's revive New Hampshire's downtowns.
Yeah, you see these kinds of projects in cities all around the country, sort of art installations, interactive installations for people, helps with kind of foot traffic and getting people out and about. This was actually, interestingly enough, based on an international street piano project back in 2008, where this particular program put 1,500 pianos in about 50 cities.
Wow.
So this is kind of inspired by that.
Wow. And this is reading from the Nashua Telegraph here. The Street Piano Project in Nashua is inspired by British artist Luke Jerram's internationally touring Play Me I'm Yours. So picking up on what you said, yep. Dean, Street Piano Project, and the Gate City is getting ready for this unique musical experience. Again, I want to also acknowledge that Littleton's been doing this for some time. Another fun story, guys. Now, I'm not a sports person, but a New Hampshire native, again from Nashua, got the dream job. The dream job, Gary.
As another New Hampshire native, you're saying? As the only New Hampshire. Well, no, you are, right? Yeah. I know. I mean, the dream job is to announce the Red Sox games, obviously. The, you know, the long suffering fans that we are, the misery we've gone through for years and years and years, and finally to have some success and to have this job, I mean, must be the dream of a lifetime for a Red Sox fan or, you know, somebody who's grown up with these guys.
Not for Yankees fans like me, right?
Oh, no. Are you going to admit that on the air?
I just did.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Nashua native Tim Neverett, again, he's going to be the new play-by-play announcer for the Red Sox. He sat down with Morning Edition's Rick Ganley earlier this week, and it was a great interview to just hear him talk about being a little kid and going to Fenway, and Trent's not looking interested at all in what I'm saying. You know, the smells, the grass, the green monster, and now he gets to do the play-by-play. So again, congratulations to Tim. Well, gentlemen, I always like to end the hour with looking at what you guys will be covering next week. And Gary, I'm going to start with you because I'm guessing that next week will be as busy as this week was over at the State House.
Oh, yes. The House is meeting Wednesday and Thursday next week. They have several hundred bills, probably more like 400 bills that they have to deal with in those 2 days.
How do they do that, Gary, first of all? Well, I mean, that many bills in such a short amount of time.
You have two calendars. One is called the consent calendar, which is basically all these bills that aren't controversial, or whether you're going to kill them, you're going to pass them, or whatever. They're not controversial. And you put them all on one thing, and one vote takes care of them all.
And how many are typically on the consent calendar?
Like, well, it varies.
This will
be about 200. That's very odd. I mean, usually it's like 20 or 30 maybe. Uh-huh. And then the other regular calendar, which is where you go right through every bill one at a time and take a vote. So if you can, but what people can do, people can pull bills off the consent calendar if they want to debate them or they want a separate vote on it. And that's when it gets to be very long days.
So 400 bills, hopefully for your sake, 399 of them are on the consent calendar, some on the consent calendar, but there'll be a lot of discussion there then
this
week.
They're going to go to at least 7 o'clock on Wednesday, and Thursday night, they go to 11:55, even though 11:55 may be 4 o'clock in the morning. So,
wow! Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we won't have you on the roundup next week because you got a late night on Thursday. How about you, Trent? What are you keeping an eye on next week?
I'm looking at a national story. What happens to the Republican Party? I think if you're a political observer and you were watching yesterday, that was one of the most historic days that I think we've ever seen. And so, what's going to happen next? I think that this race has the potential to completely tear apart the party. And so we're going to be watching to see what happens.
So the New Hampshire take on this, I mean, part of the tendency is, okay, we voted, we had our chance, now it's other people's turn. But you're saying this is important for us to keep track of.
This is important for us to watch. You know, I think that because we're from New Hampshire and we focus on politics so much that even after the primary, we're still so invested, right? You have so many people, so many of our readers who met the candidates 2, 3, 4, a dozen times. And so they really want – they're personally invested in seeing what happens here. And so we keep an eye on it even after the circus leaves town because I think it is so important to so many people here.
Yeah, and when you say yesterday was historic, you're talking about Mitt Romney's strong denunciation of Donald Trump.
I'm talking about the Mitt Romney speech. I'm talking about the debate. I've never seen a day like that in politics.
Dean? I'm guessing you're keeping an eye on that too. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Trent's absolutely right. People continue to be really engaged by the presidential race. I think in part because they invest so much time in it up front, leading to the primary. So absolutely, and the Romney speech yesterday was fascinating. And this split within the party has been building for a number of years, and this could be the year where it finally blows things up. We'll see what happens at the convention. It basically seems like the other candidates are all basically going to try to keep Trump from reaching the 1237, the key number of delegates you need to get the nomination. I'm also going to actually be watching the U.S. Senate race here. It's starting to heat up. Kelly Ayotte running an initial ad, taking some heat from the conservative wing of the party, potentially a primary challenge. We'll see. Maggie Hassan's campaign, very active on social media for anybody who's paying attention. So that's, you know, that continues to be a big race. And there's this underlying debate about whether or not they're gonna allow super PAC money. They've been trying to come up with an agreement. They have not been able to reach an agreement thus far. That, and also hopefully Gary will help me sort through all the stuff at the State House next week.
Well, hang on. Did you say Kelly Ayotte may have a challenge from the right?
Well, there's sort of a constant kind of sniping or hitting at the right that she's become too centrist. And it's not clear yet who that might be, but there is a lot of discussion that the conservative wing of the party wants to put some pressure on her, and one way to do that would be a primary challenge.
One thing that was really interesting, I think, in that Ayotte-Hassan race this week, these are the two probably best-known politicians in the state, right, from both sides. And UNH had a poll that came out that said 75% of people are undecided about who they're going to vote for.
And basically
75%?
Yeah. And deadlocked. And the race was deadlocked. Three-quarters of people don't know who they're going to vote for. And so if you think that if you were sick and tired of politics leading up to the primary, this is going to be an absolute bloodbath for the next – between now and November, you are going to see probably $100 million spent between the campaigns and outside money in what will be a huge battle.
Well, to leave us on a calm note with that political forecast, we did talk a second ago about Nashua's street piano project and giving a shout out to Littleton, which has done this for a number of times. We're listening now to an unidentified piano player on the streets of downtown Littleton, just doing a great job in the summer of 2012. So we'll close out with that, gentlemen. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.